Hey, are we live yet? Are we live yet? Testing. 1, 2, 3. Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's online podcast with your host, Jan Irvin. Here we investigate the religious, the mysterious, the entheogenic, the shamanic, and the Gnostic with the small g. Haven't heard it someplace else, you'll likely hear it here. So sit back and relax. Take a trip through time and a journey through your mind as we investigate the ancient mysteries.
Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 27. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. Today's guest is Professor Marlene Dobkin de Rios, author of, amongst many books and articles on psychedelic drugs, A Hallucinogenic Tea Laced in Controversy, Ayahuasca in the Amazon and the United States. Today we discuss ayahuasca tourism, neo-shamanism, and the future of psychedelic studies. What impact do the tourists to South America in seek of ayahuasca have on the cultures there? Are drug tourists hurting themselves and the indigenous cultures? What dangers do ayahuasca tourists place themselves in? Dr. Marlene Dobkin de Rios is a medical anthropologist and licensed psychotherapist. She has a BA in psychology from Queens College of the City of New York, an MA in anthropology from New York University, and a PhD in medical anthropology from the University of California at Riverside. Her area of specialization as a researcher has been hallucinogens and culture. She is the author of several hundred scholarly articles and book chapters, including two recent works, A Hallucinogenic Tea Laced in Controversy, printed by Prager in 2008, and a forthcoming autobiography, The Hallucinogenic Journey of Dr. Marlene Dobkin de Rios, 45 Years with Shamans, Ayahuasqueros, and Ethnobotanists, to be published in October 2009 by Inner Traditions. Dr. de Rios conducted fieldwork in the Peruvian Amazon and coast with the União do Vegetal, or UDV, Church in Brazil. She has worked with ayahuasca healers in urban Peru and intensely with one healer, Don Hilde, who lived in Pucallpa, Peru. Hopefully I pronounced that correctly. Her recent work has been focused on what we can learn from shamanic healing, and she has applied that knowledge to work with Latino clients in psychotherapy. Visit her website at www.marlenedobkinderios.com. And upcoming shows. Next week will be Dr. Marguerite Rigoglioso, the author of The Cult of Divine Birth in Ancient Greece, and I can't wait to have her on. That's going to be an exciting show. We'll be discussing fertility cults. Her book will be out on the 27th, the same day as the interview, so be sure to check that out. And I've already read most of the new book, and I must say I'm excited to have her on the show. It's going to be some very interesting information, so don't miss that one. Also coming up the week after next will be Wolfgang Bauer, the German co-author with Edzard Klapp and Alexandra Rosenbaum of Der Fliegen Pills, a book on the fly agaric mushroom, Amanita muscaria. Also coming up in the next few weeks will be Dr. Neil Goldsmith discussing psychedelics and psycho-spiritual development, and also England's Alan Piper to discuss entheogen use in Zoroastrianism and Islam. And also coming up will be G. Edward Griffiths, the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island. We'll be discussing the Fed and how the Fed has been set up by J.P. Morgan and the likes to basically manipulate and enslave the American people. And the Federal Reserve is an illegal system under the U.S. Constitution because it allows foreign stockholders into our own money system. So basically most of our nation's debt is actually caused by the use of our own money and the interest charged by the Fed to pay stockholders. So we'll be discussing the origins of all of that, and G. Edward Griffiths has published probably the first and oldest and probably most widely known book on the topic. Once again, that is The Creature from Jekyll Island. And the Spanish subtitle version of the Pharmacratic Inquisition DVD has been released on the pharmacratic-inquisition.com website. So please be sure to check that out and send it to your Spanish-speaking friends and families. Also coming up in the next week or two will be the release of the Russian voiceover version. The translation is finished, but Max, who has been helping with this version, and thank you, Max, is Russian and says that Russians would prefer a voiceover edition, so he has offered to get that done, so expect that soon. Also, I hope to have the Polish version available soon as well. The DVD is also available for free viewing on the pharmacraticinquisition.com website in its entirety, and it's available in English, Dutch, Portuguese, and now Spanish. So be sure to check that out. The website is www.pharmacratic-inquisition, which is inquisition.com. And if you're listening to the show and you can help with a German or French edition or translation or even possibly Arabic, I would love to get those languages out with the DVDs. So if you're somebody who would be able to help with that, I would appreciate it. And if anyone in the audience can help with transcriptions for these interviews, I would greatly appreciate that as well. I've had a few people respond. A couple of the shows have already been transcribed. I would like to get all or at least most of them transcribed, and I'd also like to turn that working on a future project with that I discussed a little bit on the show last week with Dennis that will be turning into an eventual book project. So anyway, if you can help with that, please contact me. That would be greatly appreciated. Possibly you could transcribe your favorite show, but you can contact me at contact@gnosticmedia.com about that. And the views expressed by the authors and guests of this program are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself or GnosticMedia.com. And this show is run on donations. If you would like to support this programming, please go to www.GnosticMedia.com and click on the donations button at the top left of the page. This show is not corporate media. This is independent media in the truest sense of the words. And by supporting it, you help continue our programming. Without your help, we cease to be here. I know times are tough, but if you are someone who can afford to support the show by donating a few dollars or possibly by buying a book from the website or a copy of the DVD, we greatly appreciate it. And thanks to everyone who has been donating. All of your donations are greatly appreciated. I received a couple donations this week and very much appreciated to you guys. Thank you so much. I won't mention your names because several people have kept requesting that I do not mention people's names because it feeds their ego, so I'm no longer doing that. Let's see, I still have copies of Astrotheology and Shamanism available. Oh, you know what? Before I go into Astrotheology and Shamanism, I also wanted to mention that my former co-author, Andrew Rutaji, now has his new video available for pre-order on his website, bouncingbearfilms.com, and his new video is Manifesting the Mind, so be sure to check that out. And anyway, back to Astrotheology and Shamanism. I co-authored that with Andrew, and I still have the color edition, which is numbered and signed, that will be coming with a free copy of the Pharmacratic Inquisition DVD, which alone is a $20 value. Or you can also get the book on Amazon.com for about $40.35, which is about 22% off of the cover price. But instead of supporting us, that does support Amazon more than us, so we really appreciate your direct support. But if you can't afford that, we understand. And please feel free to save the money on Amazon.com. I still also have copies of my last book, The Holy Mushroom, available, and that is autographed for anybody who purchases that from the Gnostic Media website. And like always, we always greatly appreciate your support, and that's about it. If you would like to contact me, feel free to contact me at contact@gnosticmedia.com. And here's my interview with Marlene Dobkin de Rios. Enjoy the show. Marlene, how are you doing this morning?
Fine, thank you.
Are you ready to get the interview underway?
Yes, certainly.
All right. Would you like to discuss your educational background?
Well, my name is Marlene Dobkin de Rios, and I have a bachelor's from Queens College in New York in psychology. I have an MA in anthropology from New York University, a PhD in medical anthropology from University of California, Riverside, and a postdoctoral year at UC, University of California, San Francisco, in the medical anthropology program.
And how did you get into anthropology?
Well, as I remember, I was very interested in social work, actually, and those were taught in departments of sociology. And I didn't do any undergraduate training in anthropology. I think I took just one course at the very end. And then as I started looking into the sociology department, it was early 1960s, and a lot of African nations were becoming independent. It was kind of an exciting time. So I guess I slipped into anthropology just in terms of looking to continue my education.
And you also teach psychiatry at UC Irvine, or?
Yeah, I'm an associate clinical professor of psychiatry at UC Irvine. I think that was your question, right, what my role was there. And I do a lecture series once a year for the psychiatry residents and fellows, mostly on my second area of interest, which is Latino mental health.
And how has your double major benefited your studies?
Well, anthropology is a study of the group behavior, while psychology tends to focus on the individual. So you kind of get all the bases covered when you do both. But within anthropology, anthropology is the study of humankind. As a result, you can have economic anthropology, you can have medical anthropology, psychological anthropology, whatever you want to study is grist for the mill.
How did you get interested in studying the indigenous use of plants?
Well, I was looking around for a PhD dissertation topic. I had finished my graduate work at NYU for the PhD. And socially, I was invited to a dinner, and I met was actually a psychiatrist who grew up in Iquitos. And on his honeymoon, he took his wife to ayahuasca sessions, and it was very romantic, with people having diarrhea and vomiting in the bushes. Not supposed to laugh at your own jokes, right? So he was at the time up in Canada at McGill, and he was doing some forensic psychiatry training, and he wanted to go back and study ayahuasca. This was in the early 1960s. So he was told there at their transcultural psychiatry group that he needed an anthropologist. I needed a topic for my dissertation. He needed somebody to look at the sociocultural end of things. And so we collaborated and got funding to go off to the Amazon. So it really was his project.
In your opinion, why has the understanding of entheogens been underplayed in the study of ancient cultures?
Well, if you go back to the 60s, you had Timothy Leary at Harvard, who was doing some pretty criminal kind of things. Caused a lot of fallout, I think, and people just were very nervous that somebody as brilliant as Leary, as well trained, as established, and so on, could, quote, go off the deep end. So I think it just put a pall over everything. In fact, subsequently, there was somebody at Harvard who had studied the Kung Bushmen in Africa, and he didn't even bother to talk about entheogen use in the culture because it was politically incorrect, even though Schultes had written me that this group was using powerful plant hallucinogens. So there was just a kind of a climate, I guess you would say, where people stayed away from the notion that their people didn't use drugs. In fact, some of my studies on the Maya were like that. That when I, in 1974, when I first published on the Maya, ancient Maya use of drugs, plant hallucinogens, there was a total denial by some very major scholars in the area. And then subsequently, it was found that there were psychedelics used, and it must have been a terrible shock for these folks.
Yeah, I suppose back at that time, I guess today we really have from the anthropology perspective, and I've talked to a number of anthropologists about this, and they just, if you're not including drugs in the study of a culture, you're missing a lot of the culture's history. And that the more I look in this field, the more and more that seems to be true. And certainly your earlier book, Hallucinogens, a Cross-Cultural Perspective, makes that pretty clear too, I think.
Yes, there's a lot of data that was not hard to find, that was sitting there waiting to be culled, and related to the other aspects of culture.
Let me go off topic for a second. What cultures do we know of that don't use any form of drugs?
Well, I could give you names, but then there might be data that would just change everything.
Well, I know they used to think that the Aborigines didn't use any sort of plant drugs, and then you published that, in fact, they did.
Yeah, there's very good data on that. I remember in the 70s interviewing a famous anthropologist who had worked many years earlier with Australian Aboriginal peoples. And in as early as the early 50s, 1952, I think it was, the use of the peturi, is the plant that was used by the Aborigines, was no longer around. But there had been some historical data that the Lutheran missionaries bought up a crop one year, and then they used that to lure the Aborigines to their mission stations. Actually, there actually is a photograph somewhere of the mission stations. So there was some active role of the settlers in Australia to get rid of the use of these plants by the Aborigines. And it's interesting that in that culture, the word for trance went out of use around the same time that the plant went out of use. So there was kind of linguistic feedback as well.
So you said the plant's not available anymore. Did they intentionally...
No, I mean, it's in the botanical gardens, and I think it grows wild.
Oh, okay. What led you from all of this, and you mentioned your friend earlier, but how did you get into studying ayahuasca?
Well, like I say, this colleague, and I wrote, this was the year I was teaching in Boston at the University of Massachusetts. We prepared a grant application to Foundation's Fund for Research in Psychiatry, and that was funded in around March or so of the 1968, and we went off to spend a year, June 68 to June 69, in Iquitos, Peru, in the Amazon city of Iquitos. His job was as a psychiatrist. He was a Peruvian, so he was coming home, after these postgraduate studies. So his job was to do all the psychiatric work, and my job was to kind of understand the social context in which the ayahuasca was used. So it was a dual division of labor. And if it had worked well, it would have been quite exciting, but he just started taking ayahuasca and was never heard from again. It's terrible. It's like the coal miner's disease. You go dig up coal, your lungs get black. You need to study drugs, you can forget why you're there.
Either that or maybe he found why he was there.
But he was, it's a dishonesty thing. I mean, take money from funders to do a project and then not to do it. It's delicate. Yeah.
Well, Marlene, you studied ayahuasca used in healings, as you said, in the slums of Peru and Iquitos. And, you know, most studies really don't focus on... Ooh, that was a loud crash. Most studies don't really focus on the urban use of these substances. What was the purpose of your study, and what did you find?
Well, it was kind of interesting. You know, most research is what you would call deductive. There's two kinds of ways to do research, deduction or induction. Deduction is you start out with a hypothesis, and then you test it. You know, it's sort of a science model. Anthropology tends to be an inductive science, so you kind of... listen to people, interact with them, and then you build the hypotheses, you know, based on what you're hearing. So this was a time where there was a lot of runaway drug use in America among young people, and very little known historically or ongoing either in indigenous societies or in peasants who'd moved to cities throughout the world, or, you know, like in the Iquitos. So... we basically hung out, you know, and developed hypotheses to try and understand the role of these substances in culture. And so as far as findings, what I found was really, I think, very exciting, that at the most private experience that an individual can have, namely ingesting a plant hallucinogenic substance, the visionary content of that experience is... determined by your culture. So you get inside your soul, you know, and there you are, you're a member of your society. And so what we would call idiosyncratic behavior is really only in those societies where there is no tradition and you haven't learned what to see under the effects of these substances. The other thing that was really important was that this was a society where there was a good deal of belief in supernatural causation. So there were witches, there were people who took money to harm others, and they used these substances and bewitched people and caused them illness and even death. And along would come an ayahuasca healer who would, A, find out, you know, what the witchcraft was, who did it and why, and then B, would reverse it and send it back to the perpetrator. So ayahuasca was used for its revelatory properties. It would reveal to the healer and to the client the cause of the illness, and certainly hope for, you know, if their healer was stronger than the witch, that he could then reverse, or she could revert, well, mostly so he could reverse the witchcraft.
Yeah, it seems like dark shamanism and witchcraft is a very under-discussed topic. Would you care to discuss that for a moment?
Well, the Aboriginal materials, they call it witchcraft. What do they call it? Let me see.
Sorcery, witchcraft.
Assault, it's an assault sorcery. Whitehead, I think, has a book on assault.
I've actually had him on the show, and we talk about his work often.
Brilliant book. Very good.
Yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think, you know, everybody in every society of the world wants to know the future. The forecasting is, like, really big. And, you know, people fear the unknown. Along come illnesses. And in societies like the one I studied in Iquitos, people, when they become ill, they don't ask, you know, how is my body breaking down? What kind of germs or, you know, stuff is going on inside? They ask a different kind of question. They ask... why am I getting sick and Joe over there and my neighbor isn't? You know, what is the why question? And so then the answer is often the malice of others, evil willing. People will you, they envy you, they're angry at you, they're just plain out awful people, whatever, and they want to harm you. And so before you can start taking medicines, you have to have a kind of a setting where you know what's caused your illness. The first causality is really number one, and that's the role of the ayahuasca, is to reveal, which is really quite different than the way it's used by tourists. We'll probably talk about that in a little while.
Talk about your fortune-telling business in Iquitos.
It was not really a business. It was a data-gathering technique. When I was before I went to Iquitos, I spent a summer, was waiting for my colleague to graduate from his program. So I had, was teaching at L.A. State University, and so I had the summer off. So I went to Salas, which is a community in the north coastal Peru where a mescaline cactus called San Pedro was used by maybe 100 different healers. And so when I was there, I heard one healer say to his wife, bring the naipes down. And the naipes were the name of a deck of cards, fortune-telling cards, a similar tradition from the tarot, but more like the playing cards we use in Vegas, in casinos. So I learned about how to use the card, and the following year, when I went back to Peru to the Amazon, I brought the cards with me and started telling fortunes. But of course, I didn't take any money or anything, and then nobody thought I was good at it because I must have been an intern, since I didn't charge. So I left for an anthropology meeting in the middle of the year, and Michael Horner and then Ari Kiev, a psychiatrist, both suggested that when I go back that I should start charging because that was how it works. So I charged, I think it was one sol, which at that time the money was worth maybe a kilo of rice. And my nearest competitor was at least 3 miles away. So now that I was charging, suddenly there were lines of people, ready to have Marlene La Gringa, que sabe, who's a gringa who knows things, to tell their fortune. It was very exciting. Suddenly I had a role in the community. I was tired at the end of the day. I could commiserate. People would pull me into their houses to tell their fortune. I carried the cards around with me. And when I got back to the States, we did a lot of work on in fact, I'm still writing an article, another article on the fortune-telling cards. Some of your readers might be interested in Skeptic, and I think it was 2007, they actually published an article on the anthropologist as fortune teller. So it was a very nice way to get data, very sincere, profound information about people and their interpersonal relationships. It's very hard to get that quality of data. So the cards became what I called an ethno-projective device. People would project all their feelings and beliefs on the cards, and particularly with regard to witchcraft, evil, stress in their environment, economic issues, mothering, fathering, those kind of things.
Interesting. Is that similar to, other than not being tarot cards, is that similar to the card reader practices here that people seem to go to in droves?
No, I don't think so. They have something called the Cross of St. Andres. You actually weave the cards, and so you tell the fortune of what's happening around somebody, that's the current, what's at their hemline, what's passing away, and then what's to come, the cards above them. So there's like four dimensions. And then you mix the cards and they cut, and if the Ace of Diamonds comes up, you turn one card up, one card down, one card up, one card down, and they can ask three questions, to which the answers would be a yes or a no. And then you could count the number of cards that have been dealt to say 3 days, 3 weeks, 3 months, 3 years, So you could, and then I was charging, like 5 cents. So they really got a lot for their money. And people just kept coming back. It was really interesting. When I came to the United States, I never told the cards, except maybe as a teaching tool, in a class on methodology or something.
Interesting. So you didn't, when you got back to California, to Fullerton, you didn't start a fortune teller business?
I had a teaching position. It paid a lot better.
Who is Don Hilde, and what significance does he have to you in your work?
Well, during the year that I was in Iquitos, I met my husband, Yando Rios, and I had maybe interviewed a dozen ayahuasca healers in the community, plus going to a whole lot of sessions that were being held in the evenings. So I guess at the end of the year, it turned out that Yando's father was Don Hilde. It's short for Hildebrando, Don Hilde. was a ayahuasca healer in Pucallpa. So we took a plane down to Pucallpa and spent a few days with John Hilding. And I was very interested in working closely, intensely with one healer. It's very hard to establish that kind of relationship. Here I was, you know, living with his eldest son, and then the following, a couple of years later, I was on sabbatical, so I was able to go back, now married, you know, I think I had a young child, my daughter at the time, and we moved in with Don Hilde, and we did a more formal deductive study where we had a questionnaire with 23 variables, and you know, I don't know what you know about sociology, but the big thing is sampling issues. You know, when you take 10 people, 100 people, 400 people, 40 people, the question always is how representative of the universe are those people you're interviewing? Is it a true sample? You know, is it a valuable sample? And since I was the daughter-in-law, I was able to get everybody, forget the sample, I got the universe. So we had really generated a lot of interesting data, and I was able to publish a number of papers and then eventually a book called Amazon Healer. Unfortunately, that's out of press now, out of print. So we were able to see one ayahuasca healer up close and what brought people there and what his beliefs were and his metaphysic beliefs, and it was really quite an interesting study.
Well, you know, I've got a few of your books, and I don't even think I knew about that one.
Like I say, I published it with, Prism Press, with Australian, London, and it didn't last very long. I should have waited and not rushed, you know, to publish it.
Right.
It's hard to republish a book unless you do your own publishing.
So what can you tell us about what you call neo-shamans?
Yeah, these are basically, I don't have a lot of good things to say about them. Over the years, there's more and more tourism, people coming down to Iquitos, Pucallpa, other cities, centers outside of these cities, to have ayahuasca experiences. And there's this whole genre of people who have come on the scene to, you know, take their cash. And that's basically what's happened, what I would call a charlatan practice. These are basically con men. The word in Spanish is estafadores. These are, you know, very nasty folks.
What is the, well, discuss shamanic tourism to South America, and what is the, what is your opinion of this practice, and how do these neo-shamans tie into the whole picture?
Well, they're, you know, like I say, they're, it's, the whole thing is a, this whole phenomenon, it is a public health issue. You know, it isn't that people don't have needs, special needs, and that they're trying to solve their problems or find solace or spiritual enlightenment or what have you. But these are just very nasty people who are in it for the cash, and they don't give a darn. And so they, in addition to the ayahuasca plant and one of the admixtures that is relatively harmless, they add up to 10 different substances, which are witchcraft plants. These are the plants you give your enemy so that they can't think straight, they'll become schizophrenic. Maybe they'll die on you. It's a good way to get rid of them. And they'll mix it in just to be sure that, you know, people have an experience. They pick them up at the airport, they rush them to an ayahuasca session, the cell phone talking all the time, they leave them to find their way home in the middle of nowhere. I mean, these are terrible kinds of situations. And they're not, you know, controlled. I mean, everybody's embracing this phenomenon. Isn't it wonderful? It brings capital to the nation. The nation has declared ayahuasca as a heritage drug and things of this sort. But in the process, there's a lot of bad things happening. For one thing, many of the traditional ayahuasca healers, who are even rural or urban, they call them mestizo healers, it would be like a Chicano in our terminology, have left the rural areas where they provide a kind of what we would call barefoot medicine, you know, like in China, and gone to the city in search of wealth and riches. So there's a lot of competition for clients, and many of these people have cells or groups all over the U.S., Canada, and Europe, and maybe Australia now we're hearing. And they don't promise very good things, because sometimes they don't do any screening. And there have been a couple of deaths, one in particular where a woman had cardiac dysfunction. So there's been probably one suicide. There are a lot of psychiatric casualties. People that we know who are psychiatrists have often been called upon to rectify some of the bad things that have happened in the bad trips that have occurred through some of these negative substances. And then, you know, the dose level is not controlled, the dosage isn't controlled. And it's just, for example, there are women in a culture where women are typically not involved in the ayahuasca healing until after menopause. Mostly the women were used to make love potions and poisons so that a man would only be potent sexually with one woman and not somebody else. So that's why I don't like this whole shamanic tourism.
Okay. Let me ask you this. In your book, you mentioned that Datura is one of the witchcraft plants used. How does that compare to what seems to be an almost global use of Datura and similar scopolamine-based plants like belladonna and henbane and stuff like that in other parts of the world, and even like the Chumash Indians here in California
if you know the data on the Chumash, you know that the healers couldn't wait to get rid of the Datura. They had trouble controlling it. But most psychedelics, as I'm sure you know, are dose dependent, you know, so small, medium, and large is going to have different effects.
But didn't they use it for thousands of years either way?
Yeah, but the up at the Santa Barbara Museum, Natural History, there's some really good data there. They have a small museum, it's quite nice. Some of the ethno-historical studies did show that they used it, but very sparingly and carefully, and weren't always able to control it. I think you're lumping a lot of different kinds of drugs together. And the Datura's, you know, have medicinal use, like in asthma medication, but they're very powerful and they're controlled medically. We had a student at Cal State years ago, and I remember he went off. He was in some other program, PhD program at the time, and they sent him off to study some Southwestern Indian group, which had a long tradition of witchcraft, you know, and he was a kind of an obnoxious sort of individual, a kind of jarring personality. Obviously, somebody took a dislike to him, and they slipped some Datura in his beer, and he became lividly schizophrenic, and he had a book he gave me. He went back to Cal State then, and he had all these beliefs. He was insane, you know. I mean, he was sort of controlled under some medication. He was able to function. But he was paranoid. He believed there were spirits. You know, he was just like a backroom mental hospital kind of person. So these are very dangerous substances and need to be looked at carefully.
And in your opinion, what are the positives and negatives of this drug tourism?
Well, I've never said there's anything positive, did I? Did I say anything in anything you read that you can think
No,
of?
That's why I'm asking. Like to me, you can't have a negative without a positive. Usually there's some of both, so that's why I asked that.
Well, you know, I got an email the other day from a neuroscientist who took ayahuasca, and he was able to do some marvelous stuff with potassium, and he's, you know, working for the government, and, you know, he's brilliant, and he's really doing wonderful things. Or somebody wrote me a while back who was in the University College in London, who was examining ayahuasca for its possible help with Bell's palsy and Parkinson's disease. You know, those are the wonderful parts of the ayahuasca. And, you know, there was a 30-year hiatus in which there was no research done, so we don't really know I think you were going to ask me something about that. We don't really know, what benefits these substances have in medicine. We think there's probably a whole lot of stuff for illnesses that are intractable, that don't respond to normal medication, but we don't really know because there's been very little studies other than animal models for many, many years. So the anecdotal, inductive stuff like I do, you know, was the only evidence. People like myself, you know, going off into foreign lands, you know, trying to figure out how these things work. So it isn't that there isn't goodness in the ayahuasca experience, but it's, you know, goodness that may have its future potential, and, you know, and maybe one has to be a little bit of an elitist. Maybe it's not for everybody. Maybe it's the people who are prepared, the prepared mind, you know.
Right. Well, I wasn't really asking about, you know, the negatives and benefits of the ayahuasca experience itself, but more really on the tourism itself. Are there any positives that come about from the tourism aspect itself, or would you say?
Well, every testimonial that you'll hear is followed by, and I was raped, and I was beaten, and I was insulted, and, you know. So you do have individuals who have experienced the ayahuasca who maybe have good trips, but for everyone who, you know, out there who has a good trip, there's all these terrible reports of bad things, including rape and verbal assaults and neglect and sickness, you know, that comes about from poorly preparing these medications. I remember when I was in the Iquitos, you know, we were back in 2007, and we had a limited period of time, so it was a lot of up and down flying, you know, Lima to Iquitos and back to Lima, and then up to Pucallpa and back to Lima, and then in and out of the country. And so we spent a lot of time waiting in airline offices you know, you have to renew your reservation, make sure that you're on for the flight. And there were people who worked for some of these tourist companies, and they were, you know, our Spanish is quite good, and they were making jokes about them and ridiculing the people that they were picking up, and they had a bunch of tickets that they were reconfirming the reservations for. And it was so sad, you know, to sit there and listen to these people poke fun at their source of revenue. They just see them as lambs, you know, that are being herded to the kill. It's kind of hard to look for niceness in that kind of milieu.
Do you have any numbers or any idea of how many people a year are actually raped or die from using ayahuasca? I know you mentioned two, or how
many
people.
We're doing a study, Mr. Rumrill and I, trying to work with some people locally to figure out what they call pharmacoeconomics. You know, there's a lot of money that changes hands. I did give a talk in the last couple of years in Paris, and we invited the cultural attaché of Peru, who was resident in Paris, came to the talk. And afterwards we adjourned, you know, to a cafe, and I had talked about drug tourism on this trip in the talk that I gave. And he said, you know, Marlene, we should probably do a traveler's advisory warning. I said, well, that's for you to do. That's your job, not mine. But, I mean, he considered it important enough to at least bring it to the attention of some people. Of the 27 healers, and you did read, I think, my new book, Hallucinogenic Tea,
yes,
Laced with Controversy, Prager. Of those 27 healers that we featured, you know, people from that our student assistant helped us with, there were lots of reports that she got of I go to a woman healer because then I won't have any sexual harassment. But then the male assistant was coming on strongly. And, you know, people are very vulnerable under the effects of these substances. And sexual advances that are unwanted can be really problematic emotionally.
Would you compare the risks of ayahuasca and ayahuasca tourism to, say, alcohol and legal drugs in our own society? How does that compare? I mean, you hear of these stories of, you know, every Friday night, girls going out to clubs, they have a drink, they get raped, and I mean, this is seems to be, you know, a huge problem in our own society. How does that compare?
Well, I think the numbers are like 90,000 deaths a year from alcohol, maybe tobacco, you know.
Isn't that, I thought it was more like 150 in the U.S., 150,000.
Yeah, so I don't know where the number 90,000 popped into my head, but I saw it somewhere.
I think tobacco I think, is a quarter million, and alcohol is number two at 150,000, 170,000.
Yeah, I mean, every society has, you know, Andrew Weil wrote his early book, The Natural Mind, and he talked about how altering normal waking consciousness is a cultural universal. So every society does it, and every society uses different substances to do that. I don't smoke, I don't drink, I don't use these drugs, so, you know, I don't compare them. I mean, are you asking me for the lesser evil?
Well, I mean, you know, you mentioned two people that you're aware of who died in Peru, but I can think of just friends of mine in the last, you know, I've had several people that have probably four or five in the U.S. that I've known over the last 20 years that have died in alcohol-related incidents here in the U.S. So that's kind of what I'm trying to get onto. I mean, is it,
you know, I agree,
is it really
a lot of noxious substances out there, and if you're talking about, well, how can we salvage ayahuasca, which doesn't seem by itself to cause death when it's, you know, properly used, it's probably the additives that create suicidal issues and stuff like that, or mental illness kinds of situations.
Right. Well, let me ask you this.
Let me just finish this.
Okay.
That, you know, if these substances were used in a medical kind of setting, I think a lot of this issue would be irrelevant. It wouldn't be dangerous to the use of it. And when we talk about groups like the Unao do Vegetal Church, they have a very good field record because they have a medical panel, and they don't let just anybody take the substance unless they're carefully screened, you know, and most serious scholars would agree that you have to have a careful screening before you allow people access to these things. And that the comparison isn't so much alcohol, tobacco versus ayahuasca, but what is being called in Europe the DIY phenomena, do-it-yourself kind of stuff, and that's really scary. There's a lot of, you know, people using drugs just like they would use some of the drugs of abuse here in this society.
So do you think that it's okay for people to occasionally experiment by themselves with it, or do you think that's totally not okay?
No, that's totally not okay.
Okay. And
I mean, I don't have stats. Probably the Dutch government keeps records, but, you know, I don't see anything being published on that.
Right.
But we do, we've gotten papers in some of the journals I work with on the do-it-yourself phenomena. So it is certainly, you know, nobody's going to tell me what to do kind of attitude.
In your book, you say that these drug tourists are often ill-informed and lacking any self-esteem, and they're looking to take ayahuasca for their own selfish needs and their own spiritual development. But you also show that a majority go for this healing and for depression and for spiritual purposes, etc. Based on the evidence that you've presented, it also seems to be that many of the primary reasons that what I'm getting at is a lot of the primary reasons that the natives take ayahuasca for sickness and spiritual awareness and depression and things like that are the same reasons that the tourists take them for. So how are the tourists different? Or is it just because they...
Well, remember, we talked about the witchcraft beliefs.
Right.
So the ayahuasca is used as a revelatory agent. It also appears to have what they call in psychiatry anxiolytic properties. That means anxiety diminishing properties. So in a society with a lot, and every society has its stressors, you know, the stressors may be different and so on. But so basically you feel better for a long time after you take the ayahuasca, and you, it also, it's really funny, it's a vermifuge. So in an area we have a lot of worms that are airborne, They get into your intestines and you get a lot of cramping and illness. The ayahuasca is also a purge, and it's a healthful kind of a substance. Arevalo, who's a Shipibo healer that we worked with, he's one of the good guys out there. He, in an interview he had with Mr. Rimrill, my co-writer, you know, of the new book, he said that a lot of the people, he sees a lot of tourists from Europe, Canada, and the U.S., said a lot of the women have had rape trauma. A lot have had a lot of both sexes have had problems with fathers, kind of a lot of interpersonal type of thing. And I suppose a lot depends on the skills of the healer. If they're just cash hungry and just want to move them in and move them out, it's going to be a lot different than the kind of psychotherapeutic relationship, plus the hallucinogen that we see underground in the U.S. for a long time, you know, MDMA, and there are other substances that were widely used as adjuncts to psychotherapy. But this is not an adjunct anything. It's a move them in. It's like cattle herding. Move them in, move them out.
Right.
The next batch,
well, in your book, in the chapter on new shamans, you show a number of groups that take tourists and people in and do these 1 or 2 week things and do screen them. So,
there's not a lot of screening.
How many of the shamans take advantage of people, like you say, and how many of them are really being careful and making sure that they are taking?
Well, you know,
care
that
of
would
clients.
Make a very good project. You know, we need to get some students together.
Because you know, it's from your book, it looks like you present almost as many or more that are careful than aren't.
Well, you know, we were afraid to send some of our researchers into places where there were known rapists. I mean, you know, people's reputations precede them. Are they going to go in with a handgun? I don't think so. So,
right.
You know, any sample is who you can get to and who would be willing to speak to you and who's not scary. Now, that brings up another topic of narco trafficking. You know, these are, again, rumors, you know. But there's a lot of money to be made in this field, and we're hearing terrible stories about, you know, the whole drug trafficking of cocaine and cocaine paste and all that kind of coca paste. Maybe moving into this trafficking with the ayahuasca, because there's a lot of money in store. I don't know. I'm just telling you what, you know,
right.
The word on the street is, kind of thing.
Understood. With people like that you mentioned here that will buy ayahuasca and prepare it and do it on their own.
Here in the U.S., you mean?
Right. How many of those, do we have any numbers of how many of those type of people that do it on their own, the sort of self...
No, I don't have any data on that. Sorry.
Don't have any data on that?
No.
Okay. I'm just, what do you base your opinion on that it's completely a bad thing to do it on your own?
Well, I mean, it's just an uncharted area. You just don't know. You know, people often do it by themselves. Historically, these substances were never taken, well, not never, but generally not taken in a solitary way. You know, there's always a shaman, there's music, there's... sorts of controls, you know, this inculcation of beliefs, you know, there's a spirit force that you're supposed to see and they will bless you and protect you, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
We're back to the 60s again, you know, people using substances, some having wonderful experiences and others suffering, you know. All I know is that I sit on a couple of journals and occasionally I'm asked to review papers, so that's how I know about the phenomena that Europeans are submitting papers in which they hung out with a bunch of people, and this is, you know, what they are doing in outer Oshkosh, wherever that happens.
And how does all of this, the tourism, the shipping drugs and things like that, how does this affect the traditional shamanic cultures of South America, and especially Peru and Guyana and
Ecuador and Bolivia and
right.
Brazil. Yeah, I think I mentioned just in passing, many of these, you know, far-flung places, the only health care that they had were these mestizo-type healers who were great botanists. You know, they knew a lot about plants in the environment, and they herbs, and they would prepare potions, you know, and things like that. But with the money to be made, many have left the rural areas and migrated to big cities where they can cash in on the tourism. So, you know, whether it's the airport or on the streets of Iquitos, people are offering you ayahuasca, you know, say it's a kind of like a beggary type of thing. So what that means is that the rural peoples are now lacking access to health care.
I had a question for you regarding that point, and you mentioned in your book about a lot of the shamans or neo shamans and things. They move to the cities, and you know, they're looking to make just make money, or you know, or looking to, as you say in your book, looking to get rich quick. How many of those people would you say do have valid financial reasons and are careful with their patients and really do try and maintain that practice even though they're charging a fee for it? Do we have any data on that type
of
thing?
Well, I did interview, we were back in 07, and I did interview one mestizo healer who knew Don Hilde. He was an older gentleman, and he was complaining bitterly about these people that were, you know, trying to get rich quick, and that they weren't paying any attention to the traditions, and they weren't carefully brewing plants. It was just, you know, one man's opinion. But it was a very sincere concern, you know, that the world that he knew was changing, and was changing really fast. So,
and that's a...
You see, a lot of this hasn't been studied. I mean, I'm kind of, you know, waving the flag, hey, wake up, somebody needs to look at these issues, you know. And the good news is there are a number of young students who are, in fact, preparing MA and PhD, you know, writings on various aspects of this, including one young woman in Wisconsin who's looking into some of the sexual abuse issues. So I think the next few years are going to be very rich in terms of an outpouring of information.
And some of your statements there about the traditional shamans, that makes a good segue into the next question. How is the traditional shamanism affected by all of the tourism and all of this stuff?
Well, one of the problems, of course, is the access to plants. You know, so ayahuasca around the cities has been kind of, you know, drunk up, so to speak, and healers have to bring the plant from further and further away. And one of the things that comes out is that in some of the outlying areas where ayahuasca is no longer available, tobacco has taken over, and you have what's called tobacco shamanism. That's certainly on the increase. And that's some of it is smoke, you know, secondary smoke, which is blown over the head and the body of the individual who's seeking help.
Yeah, would you talk about tobacco shamanism for a minute? That's a very interesting topic that I've wanted to get into. And
well, there's this the famous book by Wilbert, his last name.
He's Johannes, I believe.
Johannes, yeah. And it's called Tobacco Shamanism in South America. And there's, you know, like 150 indigenous groups that have used tobacco shamanism. And I think many of them no longer have access to the ayahuasca materials. There's a researcher in the psychiatry department at UC Irvine, where I have a position, and he's done some really interesting stuff on secondary smoke. You know, everybody thinks it's terrible, you know, flight attendants get breast cancer from in the days when you could smoke on an airplane and so on. But it turns out there's some really good data also that from a positive perspective, secondary smoke is a very therapeutic and calming. So,
wow.
Isn't that interesting?
You're on record, Marlene.
I'm always ahead of the wave, you know. My new book, Wade Davis wrote an introduction. He's so sweet. He called me an acolyte of Schulte's. And then he said that every time he came up with an idea to do something with the hallucinogens, Marlene had been there first. So anyhow, so there is some therapeutic benefit, and the healers, I used to come back from visiting the sessions, and I would smell like a bar room, you know, because they would take the back of your shirt, your blouse, and blow smoke down your back and on your head. I don't smoke, but boy, you would never know. You know, when somebody comes into a room and they're a smoker and they finish their cigarette outside and then they reek of tobacco smoke, it's very much part of the adjunct to ayahuasca healing, at least historically in the cities.
Yeah, and they don't use Nicotiana tobaccorum like we do. They actually use Nicotiana rustica, which is many times stronger, isn't it?
I think so, yeah.
Did you ever try it when you were down there?
No, I don't smoke. I smoked once when I was in my early 20s for like 3 months. I had developed this terrible cough. I was lucky I didn't get addicted to that.
So have the tourists at all benefited who are going down to South America and doing these things? Why or why not?
Well, the cultures are so different. You know, I mean, I don't think they have witchcraft issues. And there are a lot of problems. Eddie Fresca, who's an MD in New York, I think he's in one of the VA hospitals, either New York or in Connecticut there, has an article in a book. I can't remember where it was found, but there's something like 200 plants and drinks that are counterindicated when you take ayahuasca. It could be something as simple as a bologna sandwich, you know, cured meats, Parmesan cheese, all sorts of everyday, you know, stuff that you would get in a restaurant or a cafe or what have you, all of which interact negatively with ayahuasca. So there's, and particularly the MAO inhibitor plant that's used.
Right. Well,
if the healers have no training in chemistry, they don't know which way's up, you know, and I remember the one time, you know, whenever anybody's working directly with a good healer, they have to be careful not to eat certain things, to fast, stay away from grease, oils, and, you know, lard and what have you. Many of the new shamans, they don't do that. They don't know anything. I mean, some doctor in Connecticut knows more than the ayahuasca healer on the road to Nauta, which is the shaman's highway.
Well, that's an interesting statement because, to me, from having studied this field for not as long as you, but for close to 20 years, one of the things that people have brought to my attention, I would say, the most about ayahuasca is how you have to be very careful about what you eat and not drinking coffee and not taking meats and, you know, certain cheeses and dairy products and things like that, you know. You know, to me, that seems like it's one of the most things that's discussed.
Well, you must have an enlightened friendship link, you know, that's really good. But most of the people that we've interviewed, you know, they don't tell people to diet. There's a whole kind of dieta, you know, a diet, a special
right.
diet. And so it's maybe we just see different parts of the universe there.
Very interesting.
Sociological universe, yeah.
So how do you think the people in these cultures feel about this drug tourism? I know you had a section in your book on that. What do you think that the majority of people feel about the drug tourism?
Well, if they're not directly involved in it, I don't think it comes into conscious awareness. When we lived there, you know, during the year that I lived in Iquitos, the mayor was... my colleague's uncle, so I spent some time with his family. And when he realized I was studying ayahuasca, it turned out he was on an assignation. Is that a polite way to say? He had a girlfriend, and he was paying for like a hotel room, and he walked by a place where people were taking ayahuasca, and that was the first time he had heard of it. He was the mayor of the city, right, in the 1960s. So, you know, it was pretty much a very private kind of thing. Now it's... I think much more widely known, but I, you know, again, these are things that could be studied that we haven't looked at very closely. Except, you know, this one says or that one says, you can't know everything. Yeah, you know, you pull out what you want to study and you do that.
Marlene, who do you think is responsible for the drug tourism. Do you think your earlier work in your book, Visionary Vine, Hallucinogenic Healing in the Peruvian Amazon, 1972, influenced this drug tourism? And
well, you know, I've published, six books now, maybe seven, not all on hallucinogens, but most on hallucinogens, and over 300 articles. So I have an article that came out in the Anthropology News called Mea Culpa, you know, sort of posing that very question, you know, should social scientists reflect on what they publish because it may give rise indirectly or directly to some bad stuff, you know, like the tourism. And I even looked into the Catholic Index, you know, which I think is still alive and kicking in Roman Catholicism, where there's a list of forbidden books because they would harm the supplicants, you know, or the members of the church. And in all metaphysical studies, you know, whatever you're studying, like in Taoism, for example, there's a saying, know 10 things, tell 9. Not everybody's ready for information. You know, we live in a democracy, true, but there's a very famous philosopher, Ortega y Gasset, who really had a pretty low opinion of your average common man, as he called it.
And, well, that seems to be the opinion of most ancient people, is I think that, you know, the whole Darwinian survival of the fittest, and, you know, they say that, you know, 85% of the people are sheep and only 15% are capable of critical thinking, so that doesn't really... you know, that's a very widespread and common theme, and I think you quoted Houston Smith in your book on that, didn't you?
Yeah, that was his statement, yeah.
Right. In fact, I've been trying to get a hold of him for... Well, actually, I did talk to him, but I've got to go up to Berkeley and get him recorded for the show.
Yeah, well, he's an elderly gentleman, I'm sure. That's probably.
Yeah, I think he's 92 or 94 these days.
So
how do you feel today about how your work has affected the tourism industry and everything? Looking back on all of that, hindsight is 20/20. Would you have done it differently, or what would you have changed, if anything?
Well, I think the reason I've been so successful in my research was that it wasn't my project to begin with. I kind of fell into it and ran with it, you know, like a linebacker, you know, in football, you run fast enough, you get to the goalpost. You don't have to go direct across the field. You can go along the sidelines, you know, and get to the goalpost. I think consciousness is fascinating. I mean, I'm really happy to have done this research. Certainly have regrets if it was misused. But, you know, I think any field you get into always has its implications. I don't think I would do it differently if I was able to start again.
Well, that's good to hear because, you know, I like your books. They make a nice addition to my library.
Good. I'm very happy for you.
Let's see. So how can ritual be used to help limit these bad experiences? And how has... In one of your earlier books, I believe you talked about ritual naturally building up around the use of these substances when they're used, sort of creating a natural protective layer. You know, you have the ritual that protects the user, and if you don't have the ritual and you're using the substances, the ritual seems to develop around the use of it naturally, which would sort of create a protective layer there as well. What's your feeling about all that?
Well, I think the most important thing about the ritual is the use of music in the ritual. We did, in Visionary Vine, there's a couple of charts looking at other societies of the world where different psychedelics were used, and almost always percussive rhythms were used. Fred Katz, the jazz musician, and I did a couple of papers. One was called The Jungle Gym in Consciousness, and we basically say that as these... substances, you know, sort of unlock the id, and people can be overwhelmed by access to their unconscious. Along comes the music with its innate structure, and this sets up a pathway, almost like a banister. So it reclaims the individual from terror and fear, you know, anxiety, overwhelming engulfment. So I think most rituals are very carefully structured. You know, music plays a really important role. sometimes there's other things that heighten the senses, but, you know, one would have to go into specific detail. And, you know, ritual, of course, is repetitive, so it's predictable, and, you know it's coming and you know where it's going. So I think not everybody has wonderful trips with these things. You know, they can be transformed into wonderful trips, and I think the role of ritual is to do that.
So that's, you think that that's the primary thing. So that really could be, like, the primary reason, other than the inclusion of something like Datura, the lack of proper ritual or any ritual, and then the inclusion of what you call the witchcraft plants, that is the main thing really for people to be aware of. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, well, I you know, there's always exceptions, and on the one hand, on the other hand. No, I think ritual is really important, and we see that all cultures that, you know, are properly documented that have these substances, except, you know, some of the modern idiosyncratic use of these plants do use kind of a formal ritual. And it's typically encased in a musical presentation.
So does it matter if the ritual is a traditional ancient shamanic ritual or if somebody just made it up today, as long as it's a ritual?
Well, Timothy Leary used to read from the Book of the Dead when he would give LSD to people. You heard that, didn't you?
Oh yeah, of course.
Oh no, yeah.
Well, you're not.
You know, he recognized the need for ritual, even with his.
You're not supporting what Leary did, are you?
No, I'm just admiring him. I'm smart guy.
You fell right into that one. I couldn't resist. Ayahuasca clearly shows a benefit for many people who use it, and since our own society has a lack of this infrastructure, it seems to me that it's the suppression of the knowledge and how to properly use these substances in the U.S. and Europe and Canada that is largely responsible for the drug tourism. In your opinion, what is the safest and most effective way to protect all parties involved that use ayahuasca, the patient or the tourist, the indigenous shamans, the mestizo population, and the jungle as well?
Well, I, you know, basically feel that these substances need to be used in a medical setting where there's control and there's drugs to get you off the drug, you know, whatever needs to be done if there's a bad trip. And then I think the UDV use of the ayahuasca as a sacrament in a spiritual setting is fine. You know, I was a visitor in Brazil. We went to 4 different cities, and we visited 11 temples, and we observed several sessions and the preparation of the substance and so on. And it was very, you know, there was no real dangers that I could see. Groups of people getting together to have a good time, I think, you know, it's like any other drug. It's just dangerous. So I would, you know, be very careful about what settings. I think that these substances may have some real medical use, and they need to be studied. So I'm all in favor of, you know, research in these areas. Put a plug in for Doblin's work. You know, he's doing fine work raising. Oh, really?
I know. I've had Doblin on the show before, as well as a few other people you've worked with, like Grobe and Groff and Winkelmann and all kinds of good people.
Yeah, so, I mean, a lot of us who are in this field, you know, really see the need for research. Some of the questions you ask can't really answer because nobody studied them, you know.
Right.
Not going to make up an answer just to please somebody. and then the UDV is a really good example. And I understand just recently the Santo Daime group in Oregon won the right to continue to use ayahuasca.
Right, that was actually a friend of mine belongs to that group, and he's actually a researcher, a PhD researcher in this field, Dr. Martin Ball.
Okay.
And, and Michael Winkelmann was up there with that group. He was the expert witness in the trial for that case, or a expert witness, I should say. excuse me. So what would you say is the cultural and historical significance of your work?
First with the mostest. How's that? Succinct to the point. Well, you know, it's just been really exciting to... it's kind of like when I left the field, I had all these ideas, and it took almost 45 years to spell them all out. I ain't finished yet.
And what is the most important concept that you would like others to take away from this interview?
Well, I'm not selling anything except my books, you know, and even then there's publishers to sell them.
Well, I mean, what's the most important idea that you want people to take away from the interview, though?
Well, I think that, you know, this tourism is really dangerous, and every time I go somewhere, you know, people want to know what I think. Should they go here? Should they go there? So I think caution is really important. And concern, you know, concern, and support for medical access to these substances, which, you know, have only recently been allowed. I wouldn't recommend ayahuasca activity because there's just too many charlatans out there.
And would you like to discuss your website, books, contact information, or anything else you would like to give out to the audience?
Sure. I have a new book due out October with Inner Traditions. They chose the title. And they're all deal breakers. If you don't go with their title, they rescind the contract. Charming, huh? Just pegs in a wheel or whatever. The new book is going to be called The Psychedelic Journey of Marlene Dapkin de Rios. Isn't that funny? 45 years with ayahuasqueros, shamans, and ethnobotanists.
And, you know, that title, that title sounds like it would sell a lot of copies. I might have to agree with Inner Traditions on that one.
I got very annoyed, but what am I going to do? You know, and then, let's see. The good news about that book is that I published very widely, and a lot of the articles are in far-flung places. So there's like summaries of 35 or thereabouts books and articles on psychedelics in different parts of the world. So it's a real source book. It's, you know, kind of an exciting source book. And then the book we've been talking about here, Hallucinogenic Tea Laced with Controversy, it sort of tries to give a fair... balanced picture of the ayahuasca. And there are some, you know, tribal peoples that Mr. Rumrill interviewed who, you know, have belief systems. They're culturally very, you know, old traditions that deserve their hearing as well. And let's see what else. Still in print is a book called LSD, Spirituality and the Creative Process, based on Dr. Oscar Janneker's work with the Sandoz LSD in the 1950s. And when he passed away, I became like a literary executor, so I was able to access the files and present both the spiritual and creative work that accompanied the LSD. So I hope these books stay in print, and it'd be nice to spend some
of course. Of course, you're the author of one of my favorite books on that I mentioned earlier, Hallucinogens Cross-Cultural Perspectives, that has been out.
That's unfortunately out of print now.
It is, but I managed to score myself an almost mint copy of that. One of these days, I'm going to have you sign it for me.
Certainly, it'd be my pleasure.
And would you like to give out your website?
Yes, it's www.marlenedapkindeRios.com. It's all one word. D-O-B-K-I-N is my maiden name.
All right. And you've been listening to Professor Emeritus Marlene Dapkin de Rios, and this is Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 27. Marlene, thank you so much for your time and for coming on the show. I really appreciate it, and I wish you best of luck in all of your future projects and book endeavors and things like that.
Well, thank you, Jan. It was a pleasure to be here.
You're welcome. And do you have any last comments you'd like to give the audience before we...
No, just keep on trucking there.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Sure. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.